Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For too many people, the image of American Indians has been molded and shaped by Hollywood stereotypes. Both villainous portrayals, more common, as well as romanticized nobility. But where do these stereotypes come from, and how do they take hold over us in our society? Well, understanding that question has been the work of John Coward, an associate professor of communications at the University of Tulsa. His first book, Newspaper Indian, examined the written accounts of Native Americans during the 18th and 19th centuries. His latest book, Indians Illustrated, The Image of Native Americans in the Pictorial Press, sheds even more light on the origins of these stereotypes, as just a glance at the woodcuts of illustrators like W.M. Carey, Theodore Davis, and later Frederick Remington demonstrate their influence on 20th century Western filmmakers and visual artists. I spoke with Coward back in January when the book first came out. He'll be featured in Gilcrease Museum's continuing lecture series, From My Point of View, this Friday at noon at the museum. We repeat our conversation today here on Studio Tulsa. John Coward, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Rich.
Your new book follows up on a book you did some years ago on the image of Native Americans through the 19th century press. In this case, it was the Newspaper Indian was the name of the book. And now this new book is Indians Illustrated. Was there much difference in how Native Americans were portrayed through the actual illustrations or through the text?
I guess in general, they are similar. My first book was news stories and editorials, the copy, the actual words and the articles. And this one is on images, that's right. And they're similar. And what I did find in the Indians Illustrated is that some of the illustrations don't speak for themselves very well. Some do, but some, you have to read the article or the caption and the article to get the full meaning of the picture. I mean, I read some photo history and kind of photo theory, and that's clear from the literature that sometimes the caption fixes the meaning. What is this? You know, I'm looking at this picture. What does it mean? If you read the story and the caption, that obviously explains it. And so sometimes the explanation is what you think, and sometimes it's ambiguous or it's different and it contradicts what you think.
Yeah, that's one of the things that was really interesting to me as I was looking through the book, is that you would show off an illustration that would portray one sort of viewpoint of a Native American, and you would write, this is, you know, if you actually read the article, it was diametrically opposed.
Right. Yeah.
You would have an image of a warlike Native American, sort of a rapacious image of something to be feared, and yet the article would be talking about how whites were actually encroaching on Native Americans and doing some of the same things that the illustration said the Native Americans were doing to whites.
Yeah, I was surprised by that. And actually, in some of my early, our early dive into some of this material, I made that mistake. I'd see the image and go, oh, here's a really racist image. They're portraying the bloodthirsty savage. And on the surface, that's what it looks like. But then, yeah, as you said, you read the story and, oh, wait, that's not quite. I mean, the picture shows that a Native American with a scalping knife, well-armed and looking, on the warpath. One of them says on the warpath.
Yeah.
But the article explains it. Said, well, he is on the warpath, but he's escaping from the whites who are overtaking his land, and he's really fleeing for his life. So he's fighting for his side, and go, oh, this is surprisingly sympathetic. And I did find that. I mean, I actually found that in the earlier book, too, that although in the main coverage that Indians get in the 19th century is negative, as you would expect, there's some surprisingly sympathetic coverage, and in this case, some surprisingly sympathetic images.
And conversely, sometimes you would see the noble Native American depicted in the illustration, and yet the copy would be, reviling Native Americans and saying, we have to solve this problem, and by solving it means kill the Indians and take their land.
Yeah, there are some pictures that look quite benign or, sympathetic or, just ethnographic. Oh, this picture shows an Indian ritual or something. You think, well, this is good. It's a sort of 19th century image in the what would later come up to be a National Geographic type photograph. only you read the copy, the story that goes with it, and you find, well, it's quite chock full of racism and assumptions and, you know, making fun of. There is a certain amount. Yeah, stereotypes and ridicule sometimes. Mm-hmm. But if you just look at the picture, you don't see the ridicule necessarily, but the story makes it clear that they intend to make fun of these people.
Well, when did you start seeing illustrations appear in mass media at that time, and that was newspapers and periodicals? Right. About what time did publishers start seeing that this would sell or this was a subject worth covering?
Well, Illustrated Indians is about the pictorial press, and some people wouldn't, it's not that well known today. You wouldn't know about it, but this is a time when photography existed. Photography is developed in the late 1830s. Becomes popular in Europe and the United States 1840s, by the 1850s, lots of amateur photographers, but there's no way to publish photographs in a newspaper. So that's how you get these illustrations, some of which are copied directly from photographs, and they're pretty lifelike and realistic portraits, for example. So that you get this new product in American journalism in the mid-1850s of the illustrated papers, which use these black and white engravings. They were done on wood in the beginning. But some of them are quite beautiful, kind of artistic, but they can be quite imaginative and unrealistic or fantastic. So there's what's it called, the illustrated press or pictorial press era. 1855 was when Frank Leslie started, and the more well-known one today is Harper's Weekly, which is 1857. And they continue into the 20th century, and then photography comes along, and they get less and less important and more obscure, and then they just go out of business.
Did newspapers use print prior to that, or was it simply just a written account?
Well, there were images and advertising. There were little woodcuts.
Woodcuts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they weren't used for editorial purposes very much. Now, during the Civil War, there are maps that are run, and the New York Tribune and New York Herald and the New York Times, but not so many images. So that was the niche that the pictorial press filled. So before Life magazine or Look magazine, the 20th century photo magazines, these were the big illustrated journals. They were real popular.
Yeah, and you touched on something. During the Civil War, you saw newspapers and the illustrated press
concentrate
on everything happening with the Civil War.
Right.
And really where Native Americans really become depicted was at the end of the Civil War.
I assume that
publishers saw huge spikes from having these lurid, for that day, it was lurid illustrations of Civil War battles. Once the Civil War battles are over, well, what do? Right. We do the Western conflicts.
Yeah, there does seem to be a connection. I found one incident when Fletcher Harper was the one Harper brother that ran Harper's Weekly, and he saw Theodore Davis, one of his Civil War illustrators, in New York in 1866 after the war, and said, apparently the way this is in the literature and the story that's published is they just ran into each other in New York. And Fletcher said, why are you here? You should be out covering the Indian Wars in Kansas. And, commissioned him on the spot, get out there. And Davis said, 48 hours later, I was in eastern Kansas, going to join the cavalry to cover the Indian Wars. So there was an interest among the publishers in having some exciting Western coverage, especially, as you said, after the Civil War, there was some action in the West. There's still mining camps and Western immigration and buffalo hunting. All these things are going on after the war. And Indians and Indian life and Indian war is something that the illustrated papers wanted to cover. And that is a lot of where my book is, from 1865 to about 1880.
Your first book, The Newspaper Indians, came up with this thesis that your newspaper coverage at the time depicted this sort of dichotomy of Native Americans. It was, you referred as the good Indian and the bad Indian, the noble savage, as the vernacular of the time was. And then you had the sort of the marauding Indian, the Indian that was a danger. And these both simultaneously existed. And you found the same with the graphic images.
Yeah, that's right. It does repeat the same good Indian, bad Indian stereotype. There are variations in both in the earlier book and the print part, but certainly in the images too. So you get good Indians, bad Indians, but you get these ones that are more neutral, and especially later in the 19th century, you get some that are kind of exotic or romanticized. Like in the Southwest, for example, you get Navajo women or Hopi women with pottery, that kind of image, which is a little bit different. It's not, I mean, it's more the noble Indian, but it's romanticized and almost commodified in some cases later in the 19th century.
Well, speaking of romanticized images, you brought in some images. So here's one from Harper's Weekly, which you talk about quite a bit in the book. And could you describe this image to us? Because it is very much that noble Indian sort of right. Vision.
Yeah, this is one. I kind of opened the book with this in my first chapter, and it's a kind of Indian counting coup. It's the caption says, "A Battle in the Clouds," and it's a very strapping Indian man without a shirt, quite well-muscled, and he's holding the leg of an eagle, and the eagle is fighting back. So it's a real battle. The story explains that the Indian wants the feathers for various purposes, ceremonial purposes, and for arrows. But it is a quite fantastic image. I mean, I was just struck by it. I hadn't seen anything written about it, but I was really struck at what an amazing image it is.
And it has a sort of almost a Thomas Moran or Albert Bierstadt background, you know,
right.
with the huge craggy mountains in the background and the atmospheric clouds. And
yeah, it's quite romantic. And I just say it's a noble, kind of a classic noble savage. And, you know, one of the things I looked for in interpreting these images, you know, sometimes the editors claim at both Harper's and Leslie's that these were true to life pictures. And sometimes they would say, you know, sketched by in the war scenes, they had officers. Sometimes they'd say sketched by an officer, you know, at the engagement or by our special artist in the West. And this one notably did not say it was witnessed or sketched on the spot.
And in fact, a lot of them, these illustrators never were anywhere near the
That's
scene
right.
they were depicting.
Yeah, some of the war scenes clearly, Custer's Last Stand, the Little Bighorn, or some of the other battles, there were no artists or illustrators or correspondents of any kind with the Army. So they would get, you know, back east, you'd get the written descriptions and the artist. And engravers would invent the scene. I think that's what happened here with the Battle in the Clouds, that it's a Carey, W.M. Carey, who, a popular artist of that time, he read an account or saw some other, heard about it, and created it just out of his imagination. So it's an amazing picture, and I do talk about it as, you know, one of those stereotypes, the noble savage. And here, you know, it's on the front cover of Harper's Weekly, and it struck me that they want to sell some papers. They want to catch the eye of the reader, and this is a picture that would do it because it's a pretty amazing, bold, you know, photograph. This virile, very hyper-masculine Indian man fighting off this eagle, and he's got his coup stick there. And it is, you know, it's quite a dramatic Western scene, as you said. So yeah, this is one of the things I'm trying to talk about.
What really struck me, you brought in some of these broadsheets, as how detailed the printing was on some of these. I mean, some of these are really, from a printing
right.
standpoint, I mean, they were really magnificently rendered.
Yeah, it is amazing, you know, and some of the portraits, you know, they did portraits of Abraham Lincoln and, you know, people, the historical figures that we all know what they look like as they were photographed, and they're amazingly accurate. So they did Indian men, mostly men, too. So there are images of Geronimo or Sitting Bull taken from photographs, which are quite accurate. That's what they look like from all the evidence we have. Although, you know, I've seen some Sitting Bull pictures I can think of that did not look like Sitting Bull, that were just conjured up out of secondhand descriptions and really don't depict that person. And, you know, one of the things about this Battle in the Clouds, Noble Savage, is it's generic too. He's not identified. They don't claim that it was a scene witnessed by Carey, and they don't give a time, a place, a date, a tribe, anything. So that's, you know, my argument is these are idealized, generic Indians. And you find that actually throughout the period. And yeah.
Are there any realistic depictions of, say, Indian life? For example, W.M. Carey, he did some traveling, didn't he?
Right, yeah. Yeah, Carey actually does. He's one. There are some artists, and Carey's the prime one in my book, who just kind of does some ethnographic, you know, Indian camp life. And that's not, you know, it's not as exciting as the war scenes or this kind of a noble savage imagery, but But you do get some stuff that counts as kind of ethnographic imagery. Some of the stuff from the Southwest, you know, Indian women weaving or Indians at work. Sometimes there are some images of Indians doing various kinds of labor, which is not common and not that glamorous. But they do, I think, hold up as insight into 19th century Indian life.
Did you see editorial input as far as emphasizing stereotypes, even if maybe the image didn't, the caption would?
Oh, sure, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I think I was seeing was you would see a scene and it was depicting a woman working, and then there would be this blanket statement that, you know, in the Indian village, the women do all the work.
Right, you know,
and very stereotypical statements for even today, but certainly for the 19th century.
Yeah, there is a kind of ethnocentric bias, what they call ethnocentrism. You know, you judge their culture by the standards of your culture.
Right, and in every way, Indian culture was lacking, according to that worldview.
There's a deficiency argument here. The Indians are always deficient. They're different, but they're not just different and equal. They're different and unequal. They're deficient. Yeah, and you do see it on women, too. There, I found it pretty consistently in some of the depictions of Indian women, that women as the writers and artists, the women laboring women, and that Indian men were haughty and arrogant, you know, like to show off. They were kind of showboats. And when they came, you know, they would go hunting, and then when they come back, you know, bring the animal carcass or whatever, and the women had to do all the work, and the men would sit around and you know, wouldn't work. So you see this, oh, the hard lot of the Indian woman. And so there are some depictions of that. There's a one I have in the book from Harper's by a guy named Farney, who is a Cincinnati-based artist. And it's called Toilers of the Plains, and it's Sioux women. I think they're Sioux women carrying bundles of firewood. But they're the toilers of the plains. The men aren't going to go out and collect firewood, at least according to the way as it comes off in Harper's. You know, the editors, they're what I call it sometimes an understanding gap. These reporters and artists going out west, and they see things and they try to depict them accurately, but they don't really understand.
Yeah. In addition to illustrators that are going out, there are a lot of illustrators that never leave their studios, too.
Oh, right, yeah.
Or they're using photographs.
That's right.
Which is really interesting because there's several scenes, especially during uprisings, like the Sioux uprising in Minnesota in the 1860s, the Modoc Wars later in California, or the, some of the, I think there's depictions of Seminoles, in which they're using photographs from, say, peace conferences or something like that, or some high-level conference between authorities in Washington and some of these Indian leaders. And it was like in the illustrated version, if there was an uprising, there's just something that makes them look more sinister.
Right. Yeah.
But of course, that's also the formality of the photographic process where you're having to sit absolutely still for 15 seconds or so.
Yeah. The portraits and then some of the, like, even action pictures, there are examples. There was a photographer that went out to the Modoc Wars in California, and some of the Indians who were fighting on the army side agreed to pose as Modocs. And so you get that, you know, so you get a photograph and it turns into an illustration of an Indian supposedly shooting at a cavalry or a foot soldier shooting at the army, but it's not what it purports to be. So there are examples of that. Or there's one by Carey that's in the book of the Sioux sneaking up behind a split rail fence to attack a farmer, and the farmer's in the distance with plowing with his oxen. But Carey didn't witness that. He's behind enemy lines, as it were. The Sioux would turn around and kill him. So he has imagined it. But you do get photography used in, you know, some ways which are, by today's standards, unethical, or, you know, it's just untrue. It's what, fake news.
My guest today is John Coward, Associate Professor of Communications at the University of Tulsa and author of Indians Illustrated, The Image of Native Americans in the Pictorial Press. It's published by the University of Illinois Press. It follows up on his previous book, The Newspaper Indian, which looks at how Native Americans were portrayed in the 19th century press. One of the things that's a real serious issue that comes out of this book, which I thought was really interesting you got into, was this idea of Indian-on-white violence, which just as you were alluding to, this purported scene in Minnesota. This gets to all sorts of imagery in pop culture, movies, television, film, black-on-white violence. And the same thing was happening in the 19th century,
yeah,
where it was Indian on white violence. And for the most part, was it real or was it made up?
Well, there was an incentive in the West sometimes to play down the violence because you wanted people to immigrate. On the other hand, I know in Colorado, they wanted protection. You know, Denver's trying to build itself up as a great city when Colorado, this is right.
Really depends on what was happening between the relations. If it was a matter of we want the land, then you would probably play up these images.
Yeah, so you get it played both ways, where sometimes they're trying to play down the violence, Indian violence, and other times they're screaming for the army to come out and put these Indians in their place, move them out of the way, put them on reservations, and subdue the threat. So it kind of works both ways. But there was an incentive at the illustrated papers a lot of times for action. They ran lots of, they didn't run just war stuff, of course. They ran
They were the tabloids of their day, weren't they?
Yeah.
In a way?
Leslie's more than Harper's. Harper's calls itself on the cover Journal of Civilization. So they were more genteel and appealed to more upper and middle class. And Leslie's was more scandalous and would do, but they loved to do disaster. So if there was a ship that caught on, buildings caught on fire, things blew up when they did in the 19th century, they would recreate these. Now, they had to be recreated because they didn't have an artist on the spot, but they would show the burning buildings and blown up things as they were happening, as if they had witnessed them, which wasn't always the case. So there was an incentive for them to play up some of the more dramatic things. Yeah, so you get a certain amount of drama here.
When you see some of those illustrations in the book, you can see Hollywood taking...
Oh, that's right.
You can see them take these images away as sort of almost like a storyboard for the films that would come later in the 20th century.
Yeah, I make that argument that, there were... The illustrated papers were one source of Indian imagery that carried over the 20th century. Now, there are others, you had George Catlin doing Indian pictures in the 1830s.
And nobody ever made a film looking like George Catlin paintings.
But, so there were popular prints and painters that, produced imagery. Advertising comes up later and uses imagery. But so there, it's not just the illustrated papers, but the illustrated papers and all these other popular elements, popular culture, the Wild West shows. I say the illustrated press is part of that, and sure, it comes into the 19th century. I mean, one example I have is this Theodore Davis, the one that went west for Harper's, does a stage. He's going, I think, in 1866 from Missouri to Denver, and with a party on the stagecoach, they get attacked a couple of different times and kind of have to run for their lives and stuff. And he does a drawing of this. And there are several articles he writes, and he writes one later for Harper's Monthly, the monthly magazine they do. And he helps generate this whole idea of the stagecoach attack, which gets carried into, there were other stagecoach attacks, but he makes this one pretty famous because he's there, and it gets in the press, and it shows up in the Wild, Buffalo Bill does a stagecoach, and then John Ford later makes a movie called Stagecoach.
Do you suppose that one attack sort of exponentially grew the idea of a stagecoach?
I make that argument. I can't make it definitively because I don't know that to be absolutely the case, but it is certainly, it seems like Theodore Davis was early, right after the Civil War, early in the expansionist period there, he does... write this story, draw this picture, and it's repeated. It becomes, I argue, that's a trope, and it's popular. It's got dramatic elements. You've got the horses pounding and people running for their lives, Indians chasing and shooting arrows. So it's a great story that he's able to tell, and true, he didn't make this up. Although in his case, very few people were killed. I mean, he and his party might surviving. They all get to Denver, but it's still a good story and it does seem to be one source of that, 20th century movie cliche.
Now, you mentioned Theodore Davis. It seems to me he was kind of like the press agent, he built up Custer, really.
Yeah, that's right.
He built up Custer, and doesn't he provide one of the first images of the little battle, Little Bighorn?
Right,
sort of
he does, yeah.
Portrays this Custer heroic at the center of a maelstrom around him.
Yeah, Carey's out in, Davis, sorry, I switched over. Davis is out in Kansas with Custer after the Civil War in 1860s. and does the Battle of the Washita, sort of infamous now massacre from certainly from the Native point of view, out in what's now Western Oklahoma. But and Davis is not there at the scene, but he's in Kansas, so he does cover, does pictures of this, even though they're drawn, they're secondhand. And then he's back in New York in 1876, and not with Custer, and there are no artists with Custer. But he does provide an early picture. It's not in Harper's or Leslie's, but the, one of the first images of the Custer's Last Stand. He does it for the New York Daily Graphic, which was a daily. These other papers were weeklies. By the 1870s, they started a daily that lasted a number of years and then died. But he does an imaginary picture there, which sort of sets the stage for, you know, dozens and dozens, actually hundreds of other depictions of the Custer's Last Stand in movies and in cartoons. And, you know,
other artworks. Right. I mean, there are artworks here in this state, like at Willow Rock, which depict that same vision of Custer standing at the center of this swirling storm of bullets and arrows.
Yeah, that's actually Carey. I'm confusing that. I realize I made a mistake here. Davis is with Custer in Kansas, and it's Carey, though, that does that first picture of the Little Bighorn for the New York Graphic. But those two artists between them are the source. I mean, my argument is these guys are not that well known. They're not household names, but their work is influential in creating the sort of 20th century, now 21st century, you know, Hollywood version of Indians, which, you know, Hollywood has taken up a lot of the cultural space here on thinking about Indians. So it's pretty hard to get around, you know, these days for any young person or of any age to think about Indians without thinking about the Hollywood version.
You also talk about Frederick Remington, who comes later.
Right.
But he also helps redefine this.
Yeah, Remington does. Yeah, you were talking earlier about photography. Remington takes a camera out west and takes pictures in there. He's out in Arizona later. Now, this is later, 1880. So he misses the 1870s because he's too young to be out there. But by the 1880s, he's there. And then he's one of those people that takes the camera and ends up back in New York using his photographs and props that he collects. Some of the artists do that too. They collect, you know, headdresses and moccasins and weapons, bows and arrows and things, and take them back to their studios. I mentioned Farney does this in Cincinnati.
Sure, yeah.
Remington does it in New Rochelle,
the great Western artists had their studios filled with props.
Yeah. Right. So Remington's back in New York creating these Western scenes, some of them quite imaginary. But there, you know, Remington was the master of you know, the horses pounding and the dramatic. He's the master of these sort of dramatic pictures. And, you know, one reason he's so famous today is he's really good at that, even though some of the stuff is imaginary. It's not, he was not a reporter on the scene. It's, although, you know, Harper's and like to promote him that way. He's the most accurate, you know, and the best painter of the horse and of Indians and of cowboys. He's great at that. But, you know, sometimes I say it's a fidelity problem. Sometimes fidelity is not what it's cracked up to be.
All right. Well, the name of the book is Indians Illustrated. John, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Rich.
John Coward is an associate professor of communication at the University of Tulsa. I spoke with him back in January when his book, Indian Illustrated, The Image of Native Americans in the Pictorial Press, published by the University of Illinois Press, first came out. That will be the subject of Gilcrease Museum's continuing lecture series with Professor Coward, From My Point of View, takes place this Friday at noon at the museum. Details at gilcrease.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.